Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Bats. People probably don't give them much thought except to either they either find them amazingly fascinating or a bit creepy. But then something called white nose syndrome started to seriously affect our bats, and love them or hate them, you had to be concerned for them. It had a devastating impact on our bats. Now Vermont's Endangered Species Committee has weighed in with a recommendation about a pesticide spraying program that it says should be stopped to protect our bats. We're going to hear from two people who want the program to stop mosquito spraying efforts in the Champlain Valley. Mason Overstreet is a professor of law in Vermont Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic. Mason, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And Chris Fastie is co-founder of Musalamu Woods and Waters. Chris, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or share a comment about this topic, you can give us a call. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mason, what is the Vermont Endangered Species Committee?
So the Vermont Endangered Species Committee is a committee that's actually formed via statute, Vermont, under Vermont's Protection of Endangered Species Act. And it is a committee compiled of scientific experts, a lot of academics who are governor appointees. And their role is to advise the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources on all matters related to endangered species.
And what was the decision that they made that will have an impact on Vermont's endangered bats?
So recently, they made a decision after 2 years of deliberation and investigation and reporting and hearing from experts, and they recommended to the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources, Secretary Julie Moore, that an insect control district called the BLSG, the Brandon Lester Salisbury Goshen Pittsford Insect Control District.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, it is. So the acronym is BLSG, but that they be required to apply for a endangered species permit called a takings permit because of their chemical pesticide spraying that's done at night when bats fly and feed, and that basically they recommended to the Secretary that the BLSG apply for this permit to mitigate and minimize the impacts of these bats.
Now, Chris, you're the founder of Musalamu Woods and Water. What is that?
It's a local environmental group, mostly a bunch of my neighbors. I live in Salisbury, and that's one of the five towns in the BLSG Insect Control District. And we've been concerned for several years about the district and what it's doing. And in Salisbury, we've been quite aware of the plight of the bats. Salisbury happens to be a place where the state and even the federal government has been studying bats. It's a really great place, good habitat for bats here. And the Conservation Commission in Salisbury has been aware of these bats for more than a decade. And we've just recently put two and two together and realized that what the Insect Control District is doing is probably creating serious risk to these endangered bats.
So I take it your stance on this spraying, this permit for mosquito control, is that you would prefer that the state follows the recommendation of the Endangered Species Committee.
That's correct. And that recommendation is somewhat different than the way you characterized it. Mm-hmm. I'm personally not promoting that the BLSG district stop their roadside spraying. the incidental take permit that the Endangered Species Committee recommends to the Agency of Natural Resources would not stop the spraying. It could do several things to change the way the BLSG operation performs its spraying activities, and they could easily reduce the risk to these endangered bats without stopping the public service of mosquito control.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Chris, for explaining that. Rather get it right than you not say anything at all. We've already got callers, so let's start with Stephen in Montpelier. Stephen, go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
Years ago, I think it was about 35 years ago, my friend Charles Johnson, who at the time was a state naturalist, and I would go down to the Dorset Bat Cave. And that was before they put a grate on the entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go in, and there was tons of guano and worms on the floor and thousands of bats on the ceiling. And then later, kids would go in there and with their shotguns and shoot the bats. And this was all before the white nose syndrome.
Right.
And then somewhat later, they put a grate over the door. And I'm just curious about the current status of, first of all, the Dorset Bat Cave, and second of all, the white nose syndrome.
All right, Stephen. Mason or Chris, can either of you address those two issues that Stephen brought up?
Yeah, Chris, I think I'll let you spearhead that and talk about Aeolus Cave and some of the protections that actually Bill Kilpatrick, who is the chair of the scientific advisory group under the Endangered Species Committee, has been working on.
Yeah, the Aeolus Cave is one of the, I think it's the most important cave where bats spend the winter. There are, I don't know the number, there are thousands of bats that go there every winter, and the temperature is constant enough in there that they can survive in their hibernation. And a lot of the bats that went there were the federally endangered Indiana bat, which was on the Vermont endangered species list before white nose syndrome became a problem in 2007. So now there are still Indiana bats which are spending the winter in Aeolus Cave, but probably not as many as there were 15 years ago. And there are other species of bats, too, including several that are now on the Vermont endangered species list. And the grate over that cave is a pretty clever thing. The bats don't have any problem flying through the holes in that grate, but people can't get in and out. And as Stephen said, it's really easy to disturb bats when they congregate in a cave like this. So it's a shame that people would exploit their ability to harass these bats that way.
Yeah. What's the latest on white nose syndrome?
I haven't heard anything recently, but there is the populations of bats in Vermont of several of the species. There are five species on the endangered species list, and most of those populations are still incredibly low. They have not conspicuously bounced back after the devastation 10 years ago from white nose syndrome. There's one species, the little brown bat, right, which seems to have a stable population in the area of the BLSG spray district. The little brown bat is, you can see them. They are around still. And they're not necessarily increasing, bouncing back very quickly, but it looks like the fear that the little brown bat would become extinct in Vermont is probably not valid. They're probably going to make it. All right. But still, there are very few little brown bats compared to 15 years ago.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Forbes joining us this morning. Hi, Forbes.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Interesting topic, but I live about 500 feet from what's known as the Pike Hill Copper Mines. That's where the fellow fell into one of the shafts Friday. But With the desecration of the little brown bat, basically in the Elizabeth mines, which is south of here, I became very interested and started monitoring the little brown bats here at the Pike Hill mine. And one of the things was to observe early in the spring, when they were weakened and whatnot, they would come out and you'd find them dead in the snow. And I didn't see that. And I also went into the mine and with black light, actually, and looked at them, and they looked real healthy. So I called the people that were doing the research on it and said, might you want to come out here and take a look at the environment that these bats are living in? It's a high level of sulfur, copper, and also iron. And whether the environment here might lead to possibly finding out whether that is enhances the strength and possibly alleviates the brown nose syndrome. And they told me it wasn't a big enough sampling, so they weren't coming out.
No.
So I immediately became very suspect as whether federal money were involved in the research, and as long as that those funds kept going, they weren't really interested.
All right,
okay.
Ford. Yeah, thanks for that. I know there's been a lot of research done on white nose syndrome. It's been difficult to kind of pin down exactly the causes and the effects, but that's interesting that unfortunately they didn't find that to be sampling large enough. Mason, why require this district to apply for a special permit, a taking permit, and not just ban them from mosquito spraying altogether?
Well, good question, Rich. The way the law is written, so Vermont's Protection of Endangered Species Act is extremely broad, and it's one of the most protective statutes in the state. But to get at your question, the act is intentionally preventative, so it prohibits activities that, quote, create a risk of injury to wildlife whether or not the injury occurs. And so if there's a risk of injury, like there is here, the next step is kind of an exception to the statute in the form of a permit. And it's an endangered species permit. And that permit is intended, that's really where the work begins. It's intended for the applicant who's applying for the permit to work with the state to minimize and mitigate their activities. It's not intended to immediately stop it. So again, like Chris said earlier, here, we're not saying that the spraying should stop altogether. The permit is simply a starting point for the state to work with the BLSG to minimize their impacts.
And you said that the committee took 2 years before it made a decision on this. So what did the committee base its unanimous vote on?
Yeah, Chris, do you want to answer that, or would you like me to?
Why don't you start?
Okay. So Rich, 17 months ago, a coalition of conservation groups, local, regional, and national, including National Wildlife Federation, Vermont Natural Resources Council, Biodiversity Research Institute, Defenders of Wildlife, Center for Biological Diversity, Center for Coleraine, Conservation of Wildlife, Community Action Works, and Musluma Woods and Waters. Again, I know that's a mouthful. They worked with an environmental consulting firm, Arrowwood Environmental. Arrowwood Environmental performed a report, an in-depth report looking at the impacts of the pesticides being sprayed at night when these bats fly and the impacts on the bats. And the Arrowwood report said, hey, there is a very high likelihood that a risk is occurring to these bats, and thus the Insect Control District should apply for a take permit. Fast forward, the Endangered Species Committee took up the matter in early fall 2019, and there was extensive deliberation. The Endangered Species Committee heard from the expert Jeff Parsons, who authored the report. The Endangered Species Committee heard from Dave Yates, who's with the Biodiversity Research Institute, who served as a peer review for the report, who has performed bat studies in the Champlain Valley and knows the issue very well. And the Endangered Species Committee also heard from staff from state Fish and Wildlife, et cetera. And Chris, do you want to take it from? I mean, basically, Rich, the issue was batted around, and after over a year, under the Endangered Species Committee are these kind of sub-advisory group committees called Scientific Advisory Groups. The acronym is SAG. Mm-hmm. And the Mammal SAG, chaired by Bill Kilpatrick, who's a professor emeritus at UVM,
yep.
His scientific advisory group reviewed the report and concluded in a 4-1 vote of the SAG, agreeing with the findings in the report and that a takings permit was necessary. And then it was back to the Endangered Species Committee, who made the decision that we discussed earlier.
Chris, was there any more you wanted to add to that?
Only that there are 6 members of the Vermont Endangered Species Committee. They're all scientists. They're all biologists. And they're all independent biologists. They do not work for the state, or at least for Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And those 6 biologists voted unanimously that the conclusions of the Arrowood report, that bats are at risk from BLSG's activities, was valid. And all the independent biologists who were on that scientific advisory group for mammals also agreed. So this is a very strong scientific consensus that what BLSG is doing with their roadside spraying is posing a risk to these endangered species of bat.
Well, Chris, you mentioned a little earlier that you weren't completely against spraying for mosquitoes. As a matter of fact, we've seen Triple E, Eastern Equine Encephalitis, in the state, West Nile virus. You're saying we still need to treat these mosquitoes. Are there specific spraying techniques or schedules that would make it acceptable?
Yeah, there are some things that BLSG could do to modify their operation. They could modify when they spray and where they spray, and they could also modify how much priority they put on the roadside spraying of chemicals versus other methods of controlling mosquitoes. For instance, there are some naturally occurring bacteria that kill the larvae of mosquitoes when those bacteria are applied to the breeding grounds, to the wetland areas. In fact, there are 2 mosquito control districts in Vermont, the BLSG and the neighboring Lemon Fair District. The Lemon Fair District does not do roadside spraying of chemical pesticides. They do all of their mosquito control by applying the bacterial larvicides to the breeding grounds and by manipulating the breeding grounds, making sure that people don't have pots of water sitting around in their backyard. But if BLSG did continue their roadside spraying, they could recognize that some of the routes they spray are rural, have very few people living along them. For instance, their 5 or 10 mile sections of the spray routes that they use that have fewer than 5 or 10 houses within a couple hundred feet of the road. So when they do spray the pesticides, they are not really reducing the number of mosquito-human encounters just because there's so few humans there. Nonetheless, they are doing whatever damage they're doing to the bats when they spray these roads. And these rural roads, of course, are through some of the best bat feeding habitat in all of Vermont. So it would be easy to carefully look at these, have the biologists look at these spray routes and say that it's just not worth spraying all these really rural roads. Another thing they could do is adjust when they spray. Right now they have somewhat lax rules that determine when they can spray. They need to catch at least 15 mosquitoes in an overnight mosquito trap. But when mosquitoes are really bad around here, you can catch 2,000 mosquitoes in an overnight trap. So it would be easy to adjust their action thresholds that allow them to spray so that they're just not spraying whenever someone complains that there are a few mosquitoes around, and only spraying when it really makes a difference to people.
Mason, normally when the Endangered Species Committee makes a recommendation to the Agency of Natural Resources, how does ANR respond?
So typically, Rich, this is kind of generalizing, but historically, the agency has seldom gone against and or disagreed with a decision or recommendation by the Endangered Species Committee. However, this case may be different.
And have they responded at all yet on this?
You know, I'll let Chris respond to that. They haven't technically. They're planning to issue a decision in the coming weeks, and that was reported by Secretary Moore at the recent Endangered Species Committee meeting last Thursday. However, it seems like from the comments that were made and their leanings that they are going to disagree with the Endangered Species Committee's recommendation.
Chris, did you want to add to that?
Well, I listened to Secretary Moore's statement at the last week's meeting of the Endangered Species Committee, and I was a little confused about what she said. She said that the incidental takings permit that the Agency of Natural Resources could have BLSG apply for would not do the work of protecting bats. And everyone on the Endangered Species Committee had already stated that it would, in fact, do that. In fact, the incidental takings permit is designed to do exactly that. So I don't know why Secretary Moore stated that it wouldn't. So I'm a little bit confused about that. But she did also say that the agency is working with another agency, the Agency of Agriculture, to come up with new pesticide regulations and possibly a new permit, which BLSG would have, and that permit would have some kind of conditions in it that would be protective of bats. So it seems that Secretary Moore agrees that what BLSG is doing is posing a risk to bats that needs to be dealt with. But for some reason, she doesn't think that her agency should have to deal with it. So I'm quite concerned about Secretary Moore's position on this issue.
That's Chris Fasti. He's co-founder of Musalamu Woods and Waters. Also been speaking with Mason Overstreet, professor of law in Vermont Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic. I want to thank you both for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Let's take a break for a CBS News update, and when we return, we're going to get primed for Saturday's Green Up Day. And a reminder, coming up at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. We just passed Earth Day. It's a great time to remind us of the importance of environmental protection and treating this wonderful planet kindly. This Saturday, Vermont goes beyond talking the talk. We walk the walk on Green Up Day when, as a state, we get out there, clean up our beautiful surroundings. For someone who hates litter, this is an exciting day to be a Vermonter. Joining me to discuss local efforts is Lisa Scalotti, Waterbury Green Up Coordinator. Lisa, great to have you here.
Good morning, Rick. Nice to be here.
All right. And John Malter, he's administrator of the Mad River Resource Management Alliance. John, always great to speak with you as well.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Rick. Hi, Lisa.
And listeners, if you've got a question about Green Up Day or you want to tell us how you've gotten involved in your community, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or 877-291-TALK is our toll-free number. And you can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Lisa, people have seen folks walking around in early May with big green bags, but what is Green Up Day?
Boy, I think it's in our family, in our neighborhood, I know it's sort of a holiday and observed every year. It's the 51st year this year that Green Up is going to be happening here in Vermont. It started 51 years ago with Governor Dean Davis, and as a way to get out and start to pick up litter that people were noticing and were not happy about, and to do it in sort of a concerted effort, community by community. And it's stuck. Vermont's one of the only states in the country that has this sort of grassroots effort that goes out and literally picks up every little town in the state. And volunteers, it's a very do-it-yourself-friendly activity. You know, people get the bags, which are organized through the statewide nonprofit organization. The Green Up organization is not a state department or anything like that. It's its own standalone nonprofit. And they have sponsors who contribute to actually make sure that there's enough bags to go around, and those bags get distributed to all of the communities around the state. So depending, no matter where you are in Vermont, you can go and get bags in your town to go out and pick them up. You can use regular trash bags, but the green ones are fun, and they're really heavy, and so they sort of do the job really well. And then people, you know, basically go out and pick up along roadsides, along in parks, schools, mostly public property. We try to discourage people from going onto private property to go picking up garbage. But there's plenty of debris that you see, trash, bottles, cans, all sorts of stuff that are just, you know, becomes really apparent as soon as the snow melts in the spring and you're driving around or biking or walking and you see it. And this is a way to sort of, you know, when you see it and it might irritate you to go out and just pick a stretch of road anywhere and start picking up.
How many people usually take part in Waterbury's event?
Oh, boy. You know, we often have all of the kids from our primary school, which is right in downtown Waterbury, go out, and there's, you know, about 300 of them. And so in addition to the school kids, we normally have somewhere around another 200 to 300 volunteers that we know about, because there also are people who will go out and pick up, and they don't come in to drop off their green up trash at one of the drop offs. They just throw it away with their own trash. So it's not a very exact science, but I bet we have somewhere around 500 to 600 people that go out to do some picking up at
some
point.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
John Malter, how extensive is Green Up Day throughout the state?
Well, we deal with the Mad River Resource Management Alliance, the five towns, Sayston, Moortown, Waitsfield, Warren, and Waterbury, but I know there are Green Up coordinators statewide. I know there are groups planning to do cleanups around the state and have been for the 51 years that this has now been in operation. I like to think of Green Up Day as kind of a wellness program for both Mother Nature and for all the participants, because we're bending over, we're getting exercise, and we're cleaning up the mistakes that have happened from the year past.
It really is incredible when you get out there and you're now taking care of a stretch of earth, and now you kind of really micromanage this area, and you're amazed by how much trash does accumulate, especially on a small scale that you can pick up. So, Lisa, how does someone take part this year in your Green Up Day in Waterbury?
Well, in Waterbury, we have a pretty a neat little tool that we started a few years back that people are really starting to catch on to, where we're doing an online sign-up. We're using a website called Sign Up Genius, and we've got every street in town and parks listed on this sign-up, where people could go in and just basically claim a spot that they want to clean up. This is very imperfect, because not everyone goes and does this, but the more people who are signing up, the better a tool it is, because then you can take a look and see where people are already planning on going, so you could decide to go someplace different. And I've been getting lots of notifications that people are actually, you know, getting on there and using it this year, which is really good. The easiest way for people to find it is to go to the town website. The town of Waterbury's homepage is watervt.com. And right on their homepage, there's one of their news items there is about Green Up Day, and the link is there to the sign up. That's probably the easiest way for people to be able to not have to remember a web address. You know, there are people who just go out on their own street and pick up. I sometimes get calls on Green Up Day from people saying, I just went out and my neighbors got to my street before I did. What do I do? And I say, it's okay. It's, all trash is fair game. So just go a little further down the road.
Go rogue. You're allowed to go crazy.
It doesn't matter who gets there first, you know. And, you know, there are people. This year will be interesting to see how it works because COVID is still a factor. Last year we had sort of a diminished participation because it was really at the early part of the pandemic, and Green Up got delayed by about a month because of the governor's stay-home order, et cetera.
Right.
But we often have a lot of offices and workplaces organize and give their employees a chance to go out, like the day before Green Up, to go out and organize and clean up near their workplace or whatever's a convenient spot for them. You know, so there's some little groups that get organized, but it really doesn't have to be complicated at all. You know, it's just a matter of going out and getting the bags and maybe getting some neighbors or some your kids and their friends. And at this point with the whole COVID question, you know, people can be outside, they can wear masks if they're together. I think it can be done pretty safely this year. And then the idea in every town, it kind of is handled a little differently. So that's why it's important for people to kind of tune into how it's happening in their community.
Mm-hmm.
Some places in some small towns, people just leave their bags by the roadside and the highway department comes through and picks them up. In Waterbury, ours is a little bit bigger and we have two designated places where we ask people to come and drop off what they've collected. And those are at the town garage up in Waterbury Center on what's Guptill Road near the Waterbury Center post office. We'll have the drop-off open from 8 to 4 all day on Saturday. Rodney's transfer station, which is the other recycling and trash place down on River Road near the Ice Center, is open 8 to 2 on Saturday, and he's collecting green-up bags as well. So those are the two places where people should, you know, come and drop off what they've found. If they find anything really big that they can't move, my phone number is on the sign up and they can call me.
That happens. Yes, it does.
But, you know, all of the towns, as John said, are listed on the website for the state is greenupvermont.org. It's all spelled out.
Yep.
And that's the homepage where every single town in Vermont is listed with the information on who the coordinators are and what how they handle Green Up in that town. According to them, you asked about volunteers, they say as of last year, there's somewhere around 14,000 plus people go out to do Green Up around Vermont. And last year they had over 241 tons of trash collected.
Well done. All right. And, yeah, it usually is kind of a fairly socially distanced event anyway. So that makes it pretty much safe for everybody to go out and help. And, again, that statewide website is greenupvermont, spelled out, .org. John, what is the Mad River Resource Management Alliance?
We're a group of five towns. It's a solid waste management entity, and we help to perform many of the specific solid waste programs that each individual town chooses not to necessarily perform on their own. We have a couple of private transfer stations in the alliance, so we don't have any municipal hauling or curbside collection of solid waste, but we do the things like helping out with the green-up programs. We do the household hazardous waste collection. We also do composting workshops and truckload sales of composters. We help with education with small businesses and with the schools in dealing with various resource management issues. I try not to say solid waste. I like to say resource management issues because we're just dealing with resources that are, in some cases, misplaced.
You mentioned household hazardous wastes. I know you hate when those wind up in the wrong places. So are there collections scheduled for those things?
Yes. In fact, May 8th, a week from Saturday, we're having our spring household hazardous waste collection for the Alliance Communities, and we're holding it over at Harwood Union High School from 9 to 1. It's a great opportunity for folks to bring all those things that go bump in the night in their basements and garages and barns and under the kitchen sink and the like to take to us.
Like we'll what kind of things, John?
Sure. We'll take all of their architectural oil and latex paints. We'll take all of their primary batteries, the AA, AAA CDs and small rechargeable batteries. We'll take compact fluorescent bulbs at no charge. We'll take up to 10 8-foot fluorescent bulbs at no charge. And we'll also take an additional 10 gallons of liquid or 10 pounds of solid material at no charge as well. And we'll take all the pesticides at no charge. So we try to provide a service for our residents and small businesses to be able to properly manage this material.
What is the product stewardship program that you have?
Well, we work with the Vermont Product Stewardship Council and the Product Stewardship Institute and our legislature and the Vermont DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation, to really work with business to encourage the proper management of a lot of the materials that are in the marketplace. And basically, instead of a linear economy where things come out of the ground, they're manufactured and thrown away, we're encouraging you manufacture something, it's used, then it gets reused, it gets recycled and goes back around and around. And we have legislation dealing with things like the architectural paints and the batteries, mercury products, and even beyond that, and things like the e-waste, the computers, which we're not taking on May 8th because we have sites around the state to take them on a regular basis.
Gotcha. Let's take another call. We've got Forbes joining us. Hi, Forbes. Calling from Corinth.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Bats to trash.
That's right.
I had the privilege of having former Governor Dean Davis own my property. And in one of his visits to me, he told me about Vermont's Green Up Day. And just quickly, he was being interviewed by a reporter from the Burlington Free Press. And on his way down 89, he had noticed what grew over winter. Tires, trash, bottles, everything you could think of. And he mentioned it to Dean at that particular time. And he said, Dean said to him, you know, this is unbelievable, but will you work with me on seeing what we can do with this? And from then, the Vermont Green Up Day was launched.
Oh, that's fantastic. A nice piece of history. Thanks for that, Forbes. I wondered about the origins because, Lisa, you mentioned started 51 years ago, 1970, which was the same year as Earth Day. Now, Lisa Scalotti, you said for your family this is a holiday, Green Up Day, but this is John's job. Why does getting involved in this Green Up operation interest you so much?
Well, I think like anybody who volunteers, you sort of just see that you see what happens with litter in your own neighborhood, right? I live where I live in Waterbury I'm on a road that leads to the Waterbury Reservoir where there's a lot of traffic in the summer, and we get a lot of litter that sometimes flies off people's vehicles or sometimes people are just careless. And you just sort of have this idea of you want to do something. You don't like looking at it and you want to clean it up. And one thing too where, you know, the schools here are really good about getting kids involved at a really young age. We see lots of families with little kids, even preschool age, going out to pick up to try to get that message across. We had a message last year from a new volunteer that had gone out with their little kids. They were like 3 and 5, and they said that they thanked us for having the opportunity to do this, and their 5-year-old just kept asking, why do people do this? And so, you know, it's kind of an instant gratification effort, you know. When you start off right now, if you go out and you drive around today and you see what things look like, and then go around next Monday after Green Up Day, it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
And it really, really makes a big difference. I think people notice the difference and they appreciate that. And one of the things that I think has been proven in different places too is that when people see trash, they're more likely to throw out more trash.
That's right.
And so I think after we've done Green Up and you look around and you're biking and walking and driving around your community and you see how nice things look, you kind of hope, like, can it just stay this way for a little while?
You're so right. Trash begets trash.
It does.
Lisa mentioned if you're in Waterbury, you can go to the Town of Waterbury site, waterburyvt.com, to sign up. Elsewhere, go to greenupvermont.org. And Lisa, if someone is going to participate, are there certain things they should bring to Green Up Day?
That's a good question. We tell people to dress appropriately, especially if you're going to be off on roadsides. The vegetation hasn't grown up too much yet, but we are seeing lots of posts from people who are out hiking, et cetera, and they see ticks. So be careful how you dress, that you're wearing pants and maybe wear gloves, and wear something bright colored if you're going to be on a street where there's traffic. Try to pick a spot that doesn't have traffic if you're going out with little kids. You know, a lot of people have like little trash picker things, those, I don't know what you call them, and maybe John knows the name for them, those things you can grab things. And also to be really careful when you're picking things up, that if you see anything dangerous, to either not pick it up or to call to report something. Be really careful if you see things that look like needles or anything that looks like it might be what like John was talking about, with various sorts of hazardous materials. You know, try to stick with the litter that you can tell, you know, paper, cups, bottles, cans, that kind of stuff. But to be really careful in terms of what you might pick up, especially if you've got kids along doing it with you.
Excellent advice. John, we only have about a minute left. You mentioned composting, which did become a law here in Vermont last summer. But how can Vermonters, and especially those in your district, learn more about backyard composting?
Well, they can get on my Alliance website, which is madriverrma.org, and we have a little section on composting, and also you can be directed to the DEC website, which has a very extensive listing on food scrap management, organics management, and things of that nature. We also are doing a composting workshop over at the Waterbury Public Library on June 12th. It will be limited and mask required, and people can contact me and make a reservation. We'll do a truckload sale of compost bins following that. I just wanted to add one thing.
Right.
We are taking tires at the solid waste Green Up collection sites at Lisa's, at Rodney's, and down at Earthwise, both the Green Up tires, and if people have tires, car and pickup truck tires, for $4 a piece. So
yeah, that's excellent. That great note. That's John Malter. He is administrator of the Mad River Resource Management Alliance. We've also been talking to Lisa Scalotti. She's the Waterbury Greenup Coordinator. And throw out those emails again. Websites, greenupvermont.org, madriverrma.org. Keep those handy. I want to thank you both for being on this morning and for your efforts to make our environment green.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to break now for CBS News. We'll be back to talk. We're going to have 30 minutes of open phones, actually, so I'd love to hear what's on your minds. And Sox are off tonight. They'll be back tomorrow starting at 6:10. They head to New York to face the Mets. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, phones are open until 10:30, so call me, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. What's on your mind? What are you seeing with our beloved Sox, or whomever you support in baseball? They got through 2-2 against the Mariners, who are a good club this year, and Yeah, we're looking like a real baseball club as opposed to last year. Now, since that 9-game win streak, we're playing a little bit below 500. I think we played 500 on this homestand. But overall, excellent start, and it's better than the Yankees. What else can we talk about? To vaccinate or not to vaccinate? I was invited by friends to join them in New Hampshire this weekend, and I had to say no, but the prospect that at some point soon I can say yes, because today I get jab number two, and that happens this afternoon, and who knows how I'm going to react in the days ahead. I'll be doing the morning show and this show, and I hope to get plenty of sleep tonight. I actually have worked ahead on tomorrow's show so that I can get a lot of rest, because I've heard it can take a bit out of you. I'd love anyone who's gone through it so far. You've got advice for me. Let me know, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Or if you've decided not to get the vaccine, if you want to talk about why not, you can join in here. No judgment. Also, did this weekend afford you an opportunity to soak up some of Vermont's emerging spring beauty? I think we might actually have a little bit of spring this year. They plan to get out for Green Up Day. We just heard from Lisa Scalotti, John Malter, talking about cleaning up our Vermont countryside, roadsides, et cetera. Would love to hear if you have plans to do that. Last night, the Oscars. I was in bed long before they occurred. But if you have a reaction to the Oscar nominees and winners, I'd love to hear about that. And then anything at the State House that might interest you, you can call in. Again, we're at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-TALK or 877-291-8255. And if you don't call, then it's 827-299-RICK-TALKS for the next half hour. We do not want that. Also, if you're a small business and you're looking for help, you might want to let us know, let people know, because right now there's still a lot of people unemployed, but not necessarily people looking for employment or, knowing where to turn for it. So, feel free. Let people know here. And if you want to sell something on the Trading Post, I always extend it to this, to when I have open phones. Although I don't think a single person has taken me up yet. But I'll keep doing it because you never know. And if you don't know the Trading Post, if it's too early and you don't get up for it, you can buy something, you can sell something. You know, you can let us know what you're looking for. If you've got an event, you want to let people know about, you can do that here. I am open for business until 10:30 at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And when I say I'm open for business, the phones are open, and it's better for you to jump in than for me to talk for the next half hour. I have been talking since 6 o'clock this morning, I could use a little break, but it's always very interesting to hear your opinions on things or your response to things. We heard earlier about endangered bats, and it definitely has registered with some of our WDEV listeners, and the effects we have on them. We've seen a kind of a shattering decrease in their numbers since the white nose syndrome, and that has really hurt. But you talk about the balance of nature and how important bats are in this. I know they're a little creepy, but man, they soak up bugs. You know, you want pest control. Our bats come out there and they hoover them up. It's just like the opossum. The opossum can't carry Lyme disease, can't get it, but it gets ticks all over its body. And they're kind of like cats. They hoover up, they clean themselves repeatedly. And so they will eat up tons of those ticks that are a problem for us. So. All right, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We're going to Wesley in Montpelier. Morning, Wesley.
Good morning. I'd like to express my concern over Vermont not having a commemorative postage stamp since 1991. That was our bicentennial.
Yeah.
And prior to that, we had one 1953, and then prior to that, we had one in 1927. So in over 200 years, we've only had three U.S. postage commemorative stamps. And I was wondering if I've contacted our representatives in Washington and haven't gotten a response, and I don't know what else I can do.
Well,
do you have any
I don't yet, because you've taken me off guard, but you are singing to the right choir. I love the commemorative stamps. As a matter of fact, I rarely buy, you know, just the flag stamps or the love stamps or those. I have been buying commemorative stamps just because since I started buying stamps. I love them. A few years ago, one of the greatest things the Postal Service did was to make all the commemoratives forever stamps, which is great, right? Because now when you purchase them, no matter what amount you paid for them, when it goes up, you're still locked in. And you used to buy them, and then you'd have to buy like a two or three cent stamp, whatever the increase was. So I love this idea. I had no idea about this, Wesley. I'm glad you're championing this cause. Since 1991, no Vermont commemorative stamp, state stamp. There have been others I've purchased recently. I think I had Kansas was the last one I had. But 1991, 1953, 1927, you definitely took the right step. That would have been my suggestion. Contact our congressional delegation. And, I'll have to figure out what the next step is. The Postal Service, not an easy group to get in touch with for anything, but there's got to be a process here, and we've got to find it out, because Wesley, I think you're leading a good charge.
Well, I know we've had 50 state flags and flowers and birds,
right?
But not exclusive Vermont stamps.
Yeah. We've had a commemorative quarter in the time we've had
two of them.
Two, right?
1991 and 2020.
Yeah. Oh, well done.
And we're going to get our own dollar next year.
Are we really?
Yep.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. I will tell you one quick story about commemorative stamps. I love them so much. And one time I was going to the post office. A friend said, "Oh, get me a sheet of stamps." And these were probably the ugliest stamps, the worst selling stamps. It was Meany, George Meany, a commemorative George Meany stamp. Even George Meany got a stamp, and he had been like the director, Department of Labor head or something. And so, you know, I bought a sheet for me and a sheet for my friend, and she refused to take them because they were just so ugly because of Ed's face. But anyway, so I wound up with two sheets of them, which I was happy about. Wesley, I'll see what I can do.
I may be wrong, but I think New Hampshire got their commemorative stamps this year.
Well, all right. We got to get to work on
that. That makes me envious.
And angry. Thanks, Wesley.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. I like that. All right, now we go to Ginger in Woodbury. Hi, Ginger.
Hi, Ginger. Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. What's going on?
Well, I called originally to talk to you about your injection.
Yes.
That you're getting today.
Yep.
Retired nurse that I am, my advice is it's a shot that goes into your muscle, so you want to use your muscle afterwards as much as you can.
Okay.
So keep it busy. One thing I used to tell patients is if you're going to go home and watch TV this evening, every time there's a commercial, you can just, you know, move your arm around during the commercial.
All right.
But they don't have commercials on Netflix or anything, so that doesn't work for you.
That's all right.
Bake some bread, you know, get in there and knead it or something.
Okay. All right, I'll keep that.
That should help, really. Other than that, my experience was, I had Moderna and was pretty similar to just getting a tetanus shot.
Oh, good. Okay.
And second one was not particularly any worse than the first for me.
That's good to hear. I rarely react to any kind of vaccination, flu vaccine shot. And I had just a little bit of muscle soreness for jab one. So.
Did you have it in your dominant arm or your other arm?
In my other arm, in my left arm.
Yeah. I always get it in my dominant arm because I use that one more, but that's just me. It works for me.
I will remember that next time. Can I switch arms this time, or do I have to go with the same arm? All right, I'm going right this time. I'm going to tell him Ginger sent me, and I'm going with the right arm this time. Thanks, Ginger.
Are you going to Burlington or Central Vermont?
Central Vermont.
Oh, okay, my gosh, they'll know me then.
I'm gonna drop your name, see if I can get a better seat this time.
Oh, yeah. Right. The other thing I just wanted to say quickly to the gentleman talking about the commemorative postage stamp.
Yes.
One way to really get attention is get a group, a classroom of small, adorable children to vote for something.
Oh, you're so
smart. And bring
it
to the legislature. Yeah, nothing works like adorable children.
Ginger, I'm going to start calling you for advice on everything.
Well, then I'll have to start charging you.
Yes, you will, and you should.
Good luck with your shot, Rick.
Thank you, Ginger. Thanks for calling. Now we go to Phil in Berlin. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Rick. Can you hear me okay?
I can. You sound great.
Okay. Hey, I've been one of these Green Up Warriors since its inception in 1970.
Are you serious?
No, I was at UVM. I was a freshman at UVM when Governor Davis instituted it, and we were all on board as students. And since then, I've been participating. But I got to thinking the other day, one of the biggest eyesores I see up here where I live in Berlin is people discard their tires so brazenly. You know, they just throw tires everywhere.
Yeah.
Why can't the state institute a tire return policy where everyone can take it maybe to, let's say, the town garage, have a tire pile there, and then the state comes along or whoever and picks it all up free of charge? I mean, with all the money we have towards certain things, you would think that there'd be just enough to afford, you know, people not charging $3 or $4 a tire. Just make it free and then figure out how to recycle it from there.
Yeah, it's a great point, Phil. I actually took mine the last time I had a couple days off, took mine in Williston to, you know, where they take them back, and it was $3 a tire, and I was happy to pay the $12, but you're right. Like, if someone has the option of springing for $12 or just rolling them into a ditch, you know, when no one's looking, they might do the wrong thing. And if we made it free, or, you know, maybe you and I need to win the lottery and just set aside, you know, about $50,000 and start the program, because I agree with you. I mean, tires have no place on the side of a road. Trash doesn't, any trash. But, boy, the idea of, you know, when they clean up the river in the North Branch of the Winooski in Montpelier every year, they pull so many tires that people just roll down the hill into it. It's disgusting. It's wrong. It's environmentally, you know, abusive. And for a Green Up Warrior like you since 1970, you probably had a T-shirt with the ecology sign on it back then, didn't you, Phil?
We did.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Hey, great idea. I agree with you. How do we affect that is another question today. We really need to make sure those tires just get collected and not rolled aside, because it's the worst thing we can possibly do to Mother Earth. Thanks, Phil.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
All right. Yeah, and stay green. What a great idea. All right. Next up is Stephen in Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that years ago when you were speaking about the North Branch and we cleaned up the North Branch on several occasions.
Yep.
And we would pull red wall tires out and these old bronze carriage lamps and carriage springs and carriage tires and all kinds of interesting older stuff.
Wow. Oh, that's, good on you for cleaning up the North Branch, but my gosh, that stuff had to have been sitting in there for for decades.
Or even longer.
Yeah, or even longer. Centuries? Oh, wow.
My goodness, yeah. Anyway, that was many years ago, though.
But is the cleanup of the North Branch still a thing? I know that was happening, I thought, every year. Has that not continued in Montpelier?
I really don't know. I do know that, we have green bags that we have. Montpelier Alive distributes green bags,
mm-hmm.
so we can each clean up our roads.
Right. And is that any time or on Green Up Day?
I think it's pretty much any time. And then the city Brilliant. Comes around and collects them on a certain day.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Well, imagine what is in some of our streams that don't get the attention and rivers that don't get the attention, unfortunately. But hopefully people will hear this, Stephen, and say, I got to do something on Green Up Day. It's this Saturday, May 1st. And I'm going to grab those website addresses again. I had greenupvermont.org is a place to go. You can also, if you're in Waterbury, go to waterburyvt.com to sign up for this Saturday. And, we had Phil, who was just before you, Green Up Warrior, been doing Green Up Day since 1970, which was the start of it all 51 years ago. So.
And could I say one other thing?
You may. Go right ahead.
Years ago, after Governor Davis was no longer in office, I worked for DEC.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me to drive him around to different environmental conferences in Vermont, New Hampshire. And we talked about stuff, and he just expressed what tremendous pleasure it gave him to, have been overseeing the passage of the Green Up Day bill.
Wow. We've heard, this is, I think, the third call today. That mentioned Dean Davis. I guess I'm going to have to do a Dean Davis show. I'm going to have to find a historian who knows the Dean Davis story so we can do a show here on Vermont Viewpoint. I think that'd be fascinating. I can't remember.
He was an amazing person.
Was he really?
He used to work at National Life.
Ah.
As a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And then he became governor, and he was a wonderful person, very, very kind person.
Yeah. Boy, I love hearing that. Stephen, thanks so much for calling today.
Okay. Thank you for
taking care.
My call.
All right. Governor Dean Davis, that's a show I got to get working on. That sounds like a show we really need to have here, talk about him, remember his legacy. All right, so I still have a few minutes if you want to call in. Boy, great calls this morning. Wesley in Montpelier wants a commemorative stamp for Vermont. It's been far too long, 30 years since our last one. Ginger in Woodbury says, when you get your shot, it's a shot to the muscle, so keep that arm busy afterwards to avoid it cramping up. And she also had advice for Wesley, get some kids involved, get school children involved to get that next commemorative stamp from the Postal Service. Heard from Phil in Berlin, Green Up Warrior since 1970. Stephen has led efforts to clean the North Branch of the Winooski, and also used to drive Dean Davis around. We're going to Worcester now, and we've got Roger. Hi, Roger. Is this Roger?
This is, Roger. Not Roger Hill.
I thought it was going to be Roger Hill. Another Roger. Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah. Real quick, like.
Yeah.
Why don't we put a deposit like we do on bottles and cans?
On tires.
On tires.
Yeah. So there you go. That is a great idea. I think it's been floated. I know people will probably fight that, but when we're spending X amount on new tires, to add whatever it is, $2 or $3. Now, would we, at that point, still turn them in or do the wrong thing and roll them down the hill? What if I buy, a set of used tires from you on the trading post? Well, you've paid the $3, right? So,
right.
Yeah, so it's taken care of. I can just go to my local control district when I get down to you know, no longer usable, and just give them my tires. Roger, I like right. that.
Have the money go into a fund, and like, you know, wherever they turn them in, mm-hmm. they get reimbursed. You know, I mean, we're picking up beer cans left and right on the side of the road. Why not? I'm sure people would be interested in going out and picking up tires if they could get like $5 a tire.
Well, that's a good point. The other thing is, you know, if we didn't have the 5 cents deposit on our cans and bottles, how much worse would the side of the road be? You're right. If there's a deposit on tires, I'll take Roger's tires off them and take them to the local control. I did it paying $3 a tire. I was happy to do it. Cleared out some room in my storage space because I didn't need these anymore. They weren't going to last a season, the ones I had. So, here you go, $12. Take my tires. All right, Roger, let me know when you're running for public office. You got my vote.
I'm already on the select board. I don't want to go any higher than that.
All right. Hey, thanks for doing that. That's great of you to be doing that. And thanks for the great call. All right. Wow, probably the best calls we've had in the 6 months that I've been doing this. So thank you all. That'll do it for now. Danny, shut down those phones. We're going to take a break for CBS News. And then when we come back, we're going to talk food. And don't forget, coming up on WDEV this afternoon, we've got Travels with Charlie at 1, and that's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Melissa Passanen is a food writer for 7 days, and she has joined me on several occasions to tell us about someone or something interesting involved in the Vermont food landscape that she's written about. What you might not know about Melissa is that she's an amazing cook and has channeled those skills into writing several of her own cookbooks and editing others, testing and tweaking all those recipes before they hit the page. Melissa has a new cookbook out called The Little Local Vermont Cookbook, Recipes for Classic Dishes. And today she's here to talk about what she has done for a change. Melissa, great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. I am sad that I did not think to cook you something and deliver it to you so you could eat while we chat, as was our tradition.
Oh, yes. Well, my gosh, that would have been too much. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our Melissa about her cookbooks, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before I even start, I have to tell you that this morning I had to protect my copy of the cookbook from Kaya here at the station, who was trying to make off with it before the show. So
it's really a super sweet little cookbook.
Yeah.
It's in a series. There are a number of them from around the tree. There is one, you know, about Cape Cod, the little local, I think, Austin, Texas. There's a New Orleans one, and they're all illustrated. And I work closely with the illustrator, too, to help her because she's not in Vermont. And so it was a really fun aspect of it, different than other cookbooks I've done where you shoot photographs of the food, and that's challenging in a different way.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Well, what goes into writing a cookbook, Melissa?
Well, this one, I think you mentioned I've done a couple others. I did Cooking with Shelburne Farms back in 2007 that came out, which was a wonderful, very big project. Yeah. And then I did a cookbook with Cabot, which I worked with their recipes. I joke that I only do cheese cookbooks, but that's not true, of course. But if you're going to write a cookbook that's based in Vermont, of course, you have to feature cheese and maple and, you know, all those apples and everything. everything. And so this one was actually really fun because it was a very focused project. It had a structure kind of already. It's fewer than 30 recipes, so it's very manageable. And I was able to use, as long as I owned the recipes, I was able to repurpose, tweak, reuse recipes that I had used in sort of other ways over 20 plus years that I've now been writing about food in Vermont. So there were things that I just knew had to be in it. And then I did, you know, and then I expanded it a little bit. But it's a big deal, and I feel really strongly that recipes need to be tested, and which I know seems obvious, but unfortunately is not always the case with cookbooks.
Oh, my. That's scary to think. Well, you talked about 20 years of recipes. That has to be a voluminous list, and this is a wee book compared to your others. So how do you pare down the list of recipes that you wound up including in this one?
Well, it was, first of all, it was an opportunity to include some recipes that I hadn't used in a cookbook before. Some, like, super family favorites. And this one, actually, the credit goes to PJ Hamill, longtime baker at King Arthur Flour, who I credited in the book. But, so, for example, maple bacon skillet biscuits, which are amazingly delicious, really simple buttermilk drop biscuit, and you make basically a super quick brown sugar butter maple thing that goes on the bottom with bacon, and then it's like an upside down thing. You flip it out. It is so good, so easy, and I've been making it for my kids and their friends for years. They beg for it. In fact, one young man who lives in California, every time I post it, I think it's my most posted on Instagram recipe, he always messages me, "Can you ship me some?" So that was one that I'd never run because it's a King Arthur one, but I was able to use it in this cookbook and give them credit. So that was a super fun one. And then, like, over the years, I've just become, I guess, my understanding of what is Vermont food has expanded. You know, for a lot of us, it's sort of those New England classics, you know, from the settlers who came from England and Scotland and Ireland. But I do have, you know, some of those in here, of course. But I expanded my own understanding, so I tried to include, like, something that reflects the Abnaki heritage.
Oh, nice.
With a Three Sisters salad, and then a dish that uses lamb to sort of give a nod to the waves of immigrants from Syria, Lebanon, and Armenia who came, you know, to fuel the textile mills and worked so hard, you know, in all of the mills around New England.
Well, just to make sure of its true Vermont bona fides, I did check to see how many recipes included maple syrup. And it was, do you want to guess?
Okay, you know, I didn't count. Please tell me.
It's about a third. It's So well
that
done.
Makes sense.
Well done. Yep. That, I thought that was perfect. The other thing that really strikes me, and this is what I love in a cookbook, is they're makeable recipes. For someone like me who's not a chef but who loves to cook, you can't do too many things at once. These are really within a nice sweet spot, delicious but makeable recipes.
Yes, I really focused on that. That's a really good point. This is a home cook recipe collection for sure. Things that aren't overly complicated and give you some options if you need sort of shortcuts. I love the smokehouse frittata, which is basically a crustless quiche. So this is one of my go-tos for, like, if I don't have a clue what I'm making for dinner. I always have eggs on hand. If I'm one of those people, if I don't have eggs, I must go to the store or the farm stand to buy some because it just makes me very uncomfortable to not have eggs in my house. So this one is, I called it a smokehouse frittata because it includes smoked cheddar, which is one of my favorite types of cheese. And then a little bit of ham, but you could really use anything. And this one uses kale, but you could use broccoli. And it's super simple. You just whisk it up and then mix in all that delicious stuff, and you have a really nice, substantial, quick supper.
You mentioned in the introduction that we can really bite into the landscape here in Vermont. Explain what you mean by that.
I know, it's funny. It's kind of a goofy thing, but I feel like, you know, I love the connection between smell and taste. You probably know this, but smell is apparently the most memory-provoking sense of all of our senses. You'd think maybe taste would be, but apparently it's smell. And, of course, I'm sure everyone knows that smell and taste are, like, integrally related. Mm-hmm. When you have a cold and you can't taste anything as well as not smelling anything, it's super frustrating. But I love just smelling stuff. Like, my husband and I were out this weekend walking in the woods in Hinesburg, and it just smells like spring. Mm-hmm. And then we came upon this hillside of ramps. And, of course, that smelled like oniony, which ramps smell like, by the way, just a little short PSA, because we're at that season where people might be seeking ramps. Of course, you must sustainably harvest. Don't take too many. And be super careful that you know what ramps look like, because there is something called false hellebore that will make you very, very, very sick that grows near ramps.
It looks a lot like ramps, yeah.
Yeah, they do. They have a ribbed look, but please Google that before you go out. They don't smell like onions, and the leaf is different. But anyway, be careful. So I just said to my husband, boy, it smells like spring. It's sort of a little muddy. You can start smelling the sweetness of the spring ephemerals, those beautiful little flowers that come out, and ramps were everywhere. So I feel like every season has its scent, and I just love thinking about that.
I love that. And Melissa, testing recipes, as you mentioned, is so vital. It's not always done. What does that entail?
Well, it's funny you should mention the maple cream pie, because that was my biggest challenge of this cookbook.
Oh, my.
Believe it or not, I had never made a maple cream pie, wow. Even though it's, like, so classic.
Yeah.
I had traveled all the way to the Creamery restaurant in Danville, Vermont. Folks may know it. It's been there for a long time. And they make an amazing maple cream pie. And I went there to taste it, to include it in a Food Network piece that I did a number of years ago about sort of best things to eat in Vermont. But they wouldn't share the recipe because, of course, it's secret and important and all of that.
Yes.
And I get that. I respect that. So I have this fairly large collection of community cookbooks, New England, but mostly Vermont. So I poured through those, sort of pulled all the maple cream pie recipes. And it's basically a custard, obviously. But it's definitely, you know, it's a no-egg custard. You thicken with flour and you cook it. And it was a challenge. I made really soupy ones. I made ones that were way too gloppy. And it's like, I mean, yeah, people want to eat your things you cook, but there was really no way. And I hate wasting things, but I couldn't really eat, you know, whole maple cream pies myself. So that one was a challenge. I do think it turned out delicious in the end. I ended up posting on Facebook, I think, does anybody have, like, a great family recipe? And two different people actually referred me to, apparently, this woman, Edith Folds, was a lifelong Vermonter and a champion of the maple industry. You probably knew her, Rick, because you know everyone. And it had a really fun little additional ingredient, which was black pepper, which I loved. It really, I don't know if folks know, there's a tradition in sort of ginger cookies in, I believe, Germany and Sweden, those areas, to put a little black pepper in your ginger cookies. So I think there's something about it. Anyway, it really, like, sets off the sweetness of the maple. So that one was my toughest.
Wow.
Definitely.
When they fail, Melissa, can you sort of reverse engineer what ingredients needed or what you need more or less of?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I've done this enough that I usually can. Yes. But it's a little frustrating when you're making a recipe that, like, you think, this isn't going to work, but you kind of have to try it the way it is for the first time to say, you know, this isn't, I won't name the chef, wonderful, highly regarded chef in Vermont, gave me a recipe for a crust for a quiche. And I looked at that recipe and I was like, there is no way that's going to work. But I had to make it so that I could go back to the chef and say, this came out like cardboard. Turned out, of course, he hadn't made this crust in years and years. He had someone making it for him. And when I finally got to her, she was like, that's not the recipe. I mean, chefs who I love dearly are notorious. Like, there's a very, very rare chef who actually knows how to write a recipe, especially for a home cook. It's not their job. Why would they?
Right.
So, you know, people always want to know, like I used to do this column for the Free Press when I wrote for the Burlington Free Press, where people could ask, you know, for a restaurant recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super interesting. And I learned a lot, but boy, it made me tear my hair out because they use ingredients that home cooks don't necessarily have. They use base sauces or mixes that they have in the kitchen for other things that are way complicated. They're always scaled for, like, you know, a huge volume.
Oh,
so you have to dial them back, you know. So it's a, as I said, a super great learning experience, but always a challenge.
I want to talk about a few recipes.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there's another recipe in here that came originally, but it comes in lots of different varieties, but the broccoli salad.
That's the one I was going to.
Really?
Yes. I
so,
love this.
I love that recipe. So this is a crunchy raw broccoli salad. Folks mm-hmm. may have heard of this. You know, there are lots of different versions of it in those kind of community cookbooks that I mentioned. The one that I used in here has a little bit of bacon and some toasted pecans and golden raisins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got like a sweetened honey mayonnaise, cider vinegar dressing. It's super simple and just delicious.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
But that one, that actually, I think I first tested a version of that recipe when somebody asked for that Free Press column for the version that came from Rosie's Restaurant in Middlebury, which is like another great classic Vermont restaurant. This isn't theirs per se, but anyway, it was just really interesting. So I definitely got exposed to lots of really great recipes from what people would request. So that was fun.
Brilliant. What is the key to making the great dish for that chicken pie supper that we love so much in Vermont?
Well, so this, of course, when I first moved to Vermont, and I've talked to lots of folks who have this experience, like a chicken pot pie in other places, and I actually grew up in England where there's a strong tradition of meat pies, you know, that would be a double crust pie, right? You know, regular mm-hmm. pie crust, or sometimes this kind of a special, maybe a hot water pie crust. But so Vermont is kind of unique in that a chicken pot pie means basically a chicken stew with a white gravy and biscuits on top, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And just delicious, and I can't wait to the day where we can all go back to the church suppers where those happen. But I think the biscuits are really key. I mean, the chicken stew is fine. I mean, it's just, you know, basically you whatever kind of chicken you want. I personally like, you know, a good amount of dark meat because that is more delicious, in my opinion, than white meat. But it's all good in a nice gravy. But then it's the biscuits, and I learned the secret to really good biscuits, actually, when I was doing the Shelburne Farms cookbook, because I did work closely with the chef there at the time, and we tested recipes both in my home kitchen and then in the inn kitchen. But the inn kitchen is mostly closed in the winter. Well, this year, it's closed again through the year because of COVID. But so it was closed and unheated in the kitchen one day. We were making biscuits, and it was chilly, very chilly. And those biscuits came out the best of ever. And it just reminds you that the key to delicious biscuits is keeping the fat really cold, because that enables that fat to then stay in little chunks and then melt in the oven, which releases air, which makes puffs
flaky
in your biscuit.
Oh, so good.
Just
as an aside, the Pennsylvania Dutch, their chicken pot pie doesn't include any crust, but big flat noodles in it, in that stew. Yeah, something to check out sometime.
That's a pie? How is that a pie?
argue with the Amish. All right. So,
no, I wouldn't.
No. Very quickly, because we're running out of time, I want to talk about something I saw you make on Zoom. This was a great Zoom author event, and we only have a few minutes, but the apple and cheddar hand pies, these are amazing.
Yes, those are so good. That's a really simple recipe. You use purchased puff pastry and a little bit of shredded cheddar and some shredded apple, and I like to put dried cranberries in it from my friend Bob, who's from Vermont Cranberry Company, and they're just so good and so pretty. They are so impressive because they get this beautiful dark golden color, and really all you've done is grate some fruit, stir it around, roll out the puff pastry, and make little triangles and brush them and bake them. Yum, yum, so good.
My kind of recipe, so makeable, and that's what all these recipes are. It's the Little Local Vermont Cookbook. Now, where can people find it, Melissa?
It should be at most local bookstores. I mean, obviously, you can order it online, but and you can order it online from your local bookstore. So, obviously, I would refer people to, you know, in Burlington, Phoenix, in Shelburne, Flying Pig. I think you said Bridgeside is near you.
Right here in Waterbury.
So, should be able to get it anywhere. And both Phoenix and Flying Pig, and frankly, any other bookstore, I am happy to sign books or autograph them for, I don't know, your mom. It's coming up on Mother's Day, right? Or anyone. Definitely Phoenix has been having me come in and sign books, as has Flying Pig. So they both know how to get me, so feel free.
I'm glad you said that, because I kept thinking, boy, the next time I see her, this is getting autographed. I can't wait. It's it's wonderful. It is the Little Local Vermont Cookbook. Melissa Passanen is a food writer for 7 days, and she's the author of several cookbooks, including this one, the Little Local Vermont Cookbook. It's published by the Countryman Press. Melissa, I want to thank you so much for being on the show again.
Thank you so much. It's always great to chat with you, Rick.
And
it makes me hungry, too.
Yeah, it does make me hungry. I also want to point people to your most recent 7 days article about the Charlotte Seed Library. People will love that. So.
Yes, so awesome. Did you know that libraries loan out seeds?
I have no idea. Thank you for enlightening me. Okay, that's it, Melissa. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care, Rick.
Take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. I want to thank our callers from Open Phones today, probably our best day of Open Phones that we've had here. That was a lot of fun. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense with Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, up next here on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.